Hi, and welcome to episode number 20 in the Signal Integrity Journal's Fundamentals Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Bogatin. I'm the technical editor of the Signal Integrity Journal. Today, I'm pleased to have with me Scott McMorrow, the strategic technologist at Samtech. Scott's been an industry icon in the signal integrity world for more than 30 years. Many of the problems that he identified even 20 years ago are at the heart of current 224 gigabit per second designs. Join me in my conversation with Scott, where we discuss some of these challenges and some of the unique solutions Samtech is championing. Well, I'm really pleased to have with me Scott McMorrow today. And Scott, what is your official title at Samtech? I always forget, is it CTO or some technical guru?
I am a strategic technologist for signal integrity products.
Okay, but you're one of the many experts that Samtech has acquired and brought into the Samtech fold, it seems. You guys have done a really good job of collecting experts in the industry all in one place.
Yeah, that's correct. It's part of our secret plan to take over the universe.
Well, yeah, you've been doing a good job cornering a lot of that expertise there and putting it to good use. I am a huge fan of Geek Speak, and you guys started that. How many years ago was that you started it?
Well, we started it, I believe it was in March or April of 2020, so right in the midst of COVID.
Okay. And what is Geek Speak?
So Geek Speak is a forum that happens once a month generally, and it's designed to provide technical information to working engineers in the industry. And we designed it out of the need to keep engineering information flowing during the COVID time when everybody was working at home. And so it's worked really well. We enjoy that. It allows us to disseminate mostly information that is germane to every design in the industry. We try to stay away from marketing propaganda as much as possible, although we still, marketing fluff does creep in every once in a while. Mm-hmm.
And it's really an opportunity for you guys to shine in your technical expertise and really establish Samtech as a industry leader in technology and technical credibility.
Yeah, that's correct. Well, as you said, we have gathered a broad spectrum of technologists in many, many different areas, beyond which we've showcased in Geek Speak. And the idea is to Geek Speak becomes a forum for which they can actually talk about what they're doing and what might be of interest in the industry. And we try to do that in order to move things along and raise consciousness within the industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And on behalf of the industry, thank you so much for sharing the talent you've collected. I've learned a lot in listening to the presentations you guys have done, and I recommend everybody spend some time on your website. We'll put the link in the show notes here, so that others can take a look at the presentations. And if you sign up, you get on the mailing list and get notifications of when the next ones are coming up.
That's correct.
So
I learned from the Geek Speaks because I don't know everything either. So when a new presenter comes up, I go, oh, that's an interesting thing that I might want to know about.
Yeah. How do you guys decide internally what the next talk is going to be and who's going to speak?
Usually it's based on willingness to actually give a presentation because as most engineers are really reticent to actually talk in public or do the work necessary to create a 40, 45 minute kind of presentation. Sometimes it's, hey, we've got a product coming out and we would like to showcase some of the technology that underlies that product, or we've got a show coming and there's a certain focus that we want to have. But quite honestly, and we try to mix it up between RF and signal integrity and crosstalk and all the different, we try to, go from fundamentals back to deep topics. And so, but mostly it's what's available.
Mm-hmm. And one of those fundamental topics that you guys have really been highlighting a lot is the role crosstalk plays in higher speed systems. If you had to kind of put a number on in the early days of the, when we started doing the 28 gig systems and NRZ 28 gig systems, crosstalk was a huge problem then. What sort of isolations were at the level of what was acceptable in those early days?
Well, so the isolations haven't really changed much. It depends on whether you're doing short lengths or long lengths, but in typical for I have for 20 years always used 40 dB as the forward crosstalk limit. So essentially, what is that? That's basically
1%.
1% crosstalk. And that's because the signals are and the crosstalking and the crosstalk are propagating it's the same, and so they see the same amplitude reduction, attenuation and reductions. For near-end crosstalk, I've always used 60 dB, so that's 0.01%. So we're basically talking a millivolt out of a volt. And that's for near-end crosstalk because you could have a severely attenuated signal traveling along the interconnect being hit by an aggressor that is very high powered and it is at full amplitude. So that takes care of the amplitude disparity. So there's always like a 20 dB difference-ish between forward and reverse crosstalk. That basically translates into a signal-to-noise ratio, right? Difference. So in forward cross in near-end crosstalk, we're concerned about the attenuation of the link. So a long link might have end-to-end 30 to 40 dB of total loss die to die. So we need the crosstalk that's received at the die to be at least 20 dB lower, which gives us a 20 dB or a 10% signal to noise ratio. And we're trying to keep that constant. What happens is that, so that wasn't hard to achieve at 28 gigabits per second. Our Nyquist is what, 12, 14 gigahertz. But as the frequency doubles, if you don't change the geometry in any way, or you don't change the ceiling, the shielding, at the minimum, crosstalk doubles. So therefore it increases by 6 dB, right? So 6 point, whatever that turns out to be a doubling is. So as a result, we have to, if we had 40 dB at 28 at 14 gigahertz, and then we go to 28 gigahertz Nyquist for 112 gigabits per second, well, gee, our crosstalk has to be twice as good, twice better, twice lower. And then you add in encoded signaling, PAM4. Well, then PAM4 also gives you about a 9.5 dB signal to noise ratio reduction because of encoding. So now suddenly, when we jump to 112 and PAM4, we got hit with a double whammy. We're sitting there with basically about 16 dB of crosstalk that we have to make up.
So the signal's
That
gone
becomes
down
hard.
and
Yes.
the crosstalk has gone up. And so that's the double whammy that you're talking about.
That's the double whammy. And then going from 112 to 224, well, we don't have the encoding difference, but now we have again another 6 dB of crosstalk. That assumes ever the crosstalk is linear. Crosstalk becomes nonlinear in the face of resonance, because resonance wants to peak everything. And so resonance can cause crosstalk to double or quadruple, depending upon the resonance phenomenon and the Q of the resonance phenomenon. So now we have to start avoiding, not only we have to start shielding things better or moving things further apart but we also have to now be concerned of these resonance that occurred out of band before are now in band at the higher frequencies.
And so what kind of structures are going to cause the resonances?
Any asymmetry will cause resonance. Naturally, a differential pair surrounded by grounds is a resonant structure, because essentially you're basically launching a negative current on one terminal, a positive current on the other terminal, which then forces the opposite currents on the grounds, the ground return paths on either side. And so we naturally create a half-wave resonator between the two ground pins. Okay, and that's a distance-based thing. And it's not well recognized. We see it in RF launches all the time, and circular coaxial vias that basically there's a circular resonator that happens. And we have to make these things smaller and smaller and smaller to push that resonance out of band. But Scott has a rule of thumb, and that is whenever you hit a sharp resonance, it influences everything one octave down. So you'll actually see the return loss start to climb. If the resonance is at 60 gigahertz, return loss will start climbing at 30, starting at 30 gigahertz. That'll be the inflection point. And insertion loss will start bending. It's not really big at half the frequency of the resonance, but it starts eating into margins as we get, you see the effect. And the effect also happens in crosstalk. The crosstalk starts essentially peaking and accelerating. We're actually we're now actually able to pass the crosstalk through shielded vias through the aperture between two vias, and that starts increasing at resonance also.
So most designers think about crosstalk in terms of the trace to trace, and it's about the separation between intra spacing between pairs, but that's something that you can engineer, you can manage, and it's pretty straightforward. But you've also identified crosstalk as a serious problem in a lot of the via fields under BGAs and connectors. How big an issue is that compared to the trace to trace crosstalk?
Trace to trace crosstalk is easy. You can solve that with a 2D solver. You can throw in a little bit of margin to cover that. But you know, typical trace spacings that you might get coming out of a 1 or a 0.9 millimeter pitch BGA, if your strip line is, it's an easy problem, and they're basically solved by geometry. With ground crosstalk problems, it's a whole lot more hideous, because we're talking about essentially three-dimensional radiation, circular radiation within the board, between the planes. And so any two boundary conditions, two vias can resonate, any multiple set of vias can resonate, different planes can resonate. If you pull back metal differently on one side than another, you can cause a resonance. You basically cause mode conversion. What happens is we have this wonderful differential field that likes to cancel. But then as soon as we throw an asymmetry in the place, we convert to common mode. The common mode is generally not well controlled in printed circuit boards. And so that literally radiates like an antenna throughout the entire system in a 360 degree fashion. And then sometimes it's a matter of where you are aligned with it, whether you're behind the shadow of a ground via that can basically scatter the fields around, or whether you're in an open area. If you look at, you can actually look at a differential pair as two dipole antennas, where in the center on the, let's call that the y-axis, the image plane, between then there's zero field strength, right? But on the x-axis, on the transverse dimension, that's where your maximum field strength is, because actually literally one signal via is blocking the other's fields, and so you get maximum strength. As soon as you add an asymmetry with other vias around it, you start creating scattering patterns, and it gets, I liken it to you're at a community pool or your local pool, and you've just gone through adult swim time. And the adults get out of the pool, the lifeguard rings his bell or his whistle, and then all the kids jump in. You went from a pretty well-contained pool with these boundary conditions on the edges where the adults are swimming kind of, nicely. And then suddenly the kids jump in and it becomes chaotic. And you literally, once you get one, more than a couple of kids in the pool, you can no longer predict what's happening. Well, we can in electromagnetics. We can predict it. It just becomes a big, hard problem.
So if you had to just offer a few guidelines of starting places to think about optimizing the design of those via fields, Before you run an HFS simulation and you try to look at the details, any particular guidelines you'd offer about assigning signals, vias, returns?
Yeah, well, so the old myth that you didn't need ground return path vias has kind of been blown at these frequencies. So you have to have them. You need vias in the transverse direction along the axis of, you need ground vias to block field on axis between differential pairs. Off axis is less sensitive, but you still need more than just one because fields like to scatter around and bend around things. And so typically we might have several ground vias cradling the left and the right side of a differential pair. That's to start with. As these become larger and larger problems, we might want to put two ground pins in between the differential vias to increase isolation. We do that
Wow.
with some of our connectors.
So you're saying you're almost treating the differential vias as single-ended vias with their own returns in proximity?
You have to, and then they have to be balanced.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they, yeah, it, and that becomes tricky because you can't always balance. So sometimes we balance by, it might be an asymmetric balance, but we basically you make sure that the ground vias are in the same proximity to both sides.
Okay, so it sounds like as a starting place, want to think about engineering the signal vias as single-ended and balanced between the pairs, and that's one way of helping to reduce their crosstalk, increase their bandwidth.
That's
Okay,
correct.
and then of course, what you said before is you can't use rules of thumb to evaluate performance. You got to put the whole structure into a full wave simulation like HFSS.
That's correct. That's
Yeah.
correct.
You know, you guys have been pioneering this idea of how you do that breakout from the either a BGA or a connector and get into that interconnect field of uniform strip line or uniform transmission lines on the board. I remember, I don't know, was it 10, 15, 20 years ago, you guys coined that term the final inch as a way of describing that transition region from uniform transmission line to the very three-dimensional sculpted structure of breakout fields.
Yeah, that's correct. Final inch was the concept was that a connector or a package does not end at the connector or package. It is part of a transmission line that extends from board to board, system to system. And the three-dimensional structures have to be crafted in order to get from one linear TEM interconnect to another. So traces are great for transporting signals. Cables are great for transporting signals. Vias not so great. So the idea is to come up with a scheme to provide that and provide that to customers so that it's easier for them to actually craft their design. If they follow our guidelines, 95% of the time, they don't have to do anything else. They just put it down and it works. Now, as you go faster and faster, as your margins become less smaller and smaller, you may have to put some more effort into it. And so that's where we came up with a new tool. And I've been working on this, been working on the theory for the last year and a half or 2 years. And the concept is that designing via transmission structures is simply work trying to design a non-uniform transmission line with periodic discontinuities. The periodic discontinuities being the planes. Vias by themselves without planes are extremely high impedance. Our planes load them down and make them a repetitive lower impedance structure within the frequencies that we're working with. And I develop, but we can have anywhere from 4 to 40 layers in a design. And you don't want to have to craft every layer individually. And I've seen designs that have done that. And I realized if you just apply a little bit of uniform transmission, loaded transmission line theory to this, you can identify what I call the zones of control near the package or the connector, near the trace, and then in between the layers should be fairly uniform and we can design those. So I basically came up with the process for doing the design and I said, well, this is BS because it's still really hard for people to do it. So let's try to do it in a commercial tool, and I used an Ansys tool, 3D layout, which is a planar tool that uses HFSS underneath as a solver. And I realized that I started ending up having to parameterize a lot of things, and I thought, gosh, I wish I had somebody to write code. I don't have anybody available. So about 8 months ago, I started working with ChatGPT and Google Gemini, and they taught me how to write Python, which is the scripting language inside of the tool. So I basically wrote a script using Python and several thousand lines of code and thousands of lines of database structures to automate the entire process of putting the breakout down, what we would recommend as the first place to start, going through the optimization process, and then expanding that to looking at an array of these launches, like you might see on a connector or a package, and then ways to visualize the routing and change the geometry of the breakout structure itself to actually accommodate the routing. So all of that is incorporated into the tool that we're just starting to roll out. We gave a presentation about Cyborg, which stands for Signal Integrity Breakout Region Guru. And we did a presentation at DesignCon, 2.5 hour tutorial showing it. I can literally put down a breakout in about 30 seconds,
And
ready to simulate.
and you're going to make this tool available to everybody, just your customers? How's that going to work?
So it is available to the industry for the ubiquitous 1 millimeter and 0.9 millimeter pitch BGA. So that'll be available for connectors. We are a connector company. It will be available for Samtech customers with prepackaged breakout rules for each connector that we make, and we're quickly developing new ones each day. We currently support several different connector families that are high speed, but we'll eventually support pretty much any of our array or inline connectors that we have.
And so for the tool that will be available for the rest of the world that does the BGA breakout, you envision that someone's going to specify, here's my number of IO and my BGA, here's the footprint, here's the pin assignment, and then here's a starting place for doing the fan out into the uniform transmission line field, and then you push the button and you look at the results.
It kind of like that. So we can't make it won't be extremely general for there are some really bad packages that have really bad ball patterns. So we're assuming high performance designs, say 56 gigabits per second or faster. And so we make the assumption that the BGA field is the signal pairs are surrounded by grounds. They do that because of crosstalk, right? That's the problem at high frequencies. And so now we now have patterns, and they're usually either square patterns of balls that for grounds or kind of an elongated hexagonal pattern, trapezoidal pattern. And we'll place that, and then you can control the VSIs by one parameter. You can there'll be the ability to control the manufacturing tolerances. So some manufacturers use 4 mils or 4.5 mils or 5 mil pad annular rings. There will be different parameters for the anti-pad or plane clearances. Those are all programmed to keep the designer out of trouble. And the first thing you'll do is place a breakout down on the board. And we actually just look, we don't even look at the trace. We just place a BGA on the top and a BGA pattern on the bottom, and then we optimize the vias for your stack up and for your particular via sizes that you have available. And what you find is that normally the via size that people pick is wrong. It's usually too small or it's too big, and there's usually a just right size. And so we'll allow the user can go through and programmatically look at that very rapidly. We also have an automatic breakout or an automatic stack up generator that will give the user, we can create a stack up from 4 layers to, I believe it's 42 layers. Automatically generated with a programmable model for the dielectric that is naturally anisotropic. So we can actually program in the XY axis versus the Z axis dielectric properties if they're known. We know that the dielectric properties in the XY axis for V is higher than, and so we program that by a correction factor. So that's all built in. Once you've got it, if you have your own, we build it with our own generic stack up. It makes the programming easier, but the customer can load in their own stack up. If they are, because they would already have this tool, they have the ability to export their own stack up and then load it back in and immediately start working. So the time to bring this up, if a stack up is available from a customer, is on the order of 1 minute to be ready to do the fundamental launch design, the fundamental via geometry selection, and anti-pad sizing from top to bottom through the board. Once you've got that, we add the trace. And adding the trace is just a it's just another design that sits alongside. It inherits all the other parameters. So all we have to do is change the way in which the anti-pads are constructed around the trace escape and a very few parameters. So it makes this rapid. Turns out that once you follow the practice, even if you had 10 routing layers, they're all the same breakout. So then you can regenerate it and say, well, I want to do my breakouts on these 10 layers, and it'll automatically build all of those designs. You can then, with one button in Ansys, simulate that. Depending on the simulation environment, it can take a long time, but it's easily doable over a night or a weekend with a small amount of processors or cores available. And you'll get all the curves for every layer transition. Press a button native to the tool in Ansys, and it'll basically create a DXF of every layer, which along with your own SI documentation can be given to a layout professional to perform the layout. And it's that simple. Doing crosstalk analysis a little bit more complicated just from the amount of computational resources available. But the designs are already set up to do that.
So and when is Cyborg going to be available for the public to be able to access?
It should be available towards the end of March.
Okay. And so the idea would be it sounds like it's kind of an intelligent wizard front end to help create the 3D structure that is going to be simulated in HFSS.
Correct.
And you apply ports to it already then?
They're already applied, ready to run out the
Okay.
gate. So you just press a button and you can run it.
Do you use lumped or wave ports on the
Waveports.
and wave
Everything is
ports?
done with, yeah, we actually use some technology available in Ansys, which is known as a 3D component. The 3D component is actually created in the HFSS environment. It's a separate component, and I already have the balls are all for the connector or the package balls are already created. They've already been programmed, so you can actually change the size, the shape of the ball, depending upon the manufacturing process or the manufacturer. They're then automatically placed on top and on the bottom or wherever. The wave ports on the traces are already placed. We basically do trace differential stubs approximately a millimeter away from the transition, and they're already set up and ready to simulate.
Well, so after you use this the tool to generate your structure, you push the button, you get the S parameters. It's still up to the person driving the tool to take those S parameters and interpret the results and figure out what they're telling you about the performance of that system.
Exactly. So I don't want to take the engineering. I'm just making the engineering easy, easier. So because SI people are not very good at drawing three-dimensional structures. I know I'm not. I've gotten better over the ages. That's not where the time should be spent. The time for a signal integrity engineer is into actually doing the actual design of the structure. The anti-pad sizing, the via sizing, the trace sizing, all of those things, and do it rapidly. So I can literally design a brand new launch for up to 112 gigabits per second in 1 day. You got
Wow.
10 of them on your board, maybe two that are the same connector, 2 days. It just basically takes the effort out of the work. I call it intelligent use of AI. I used AI to help me write the code, but you still have to use your brain to figure out how to make the system work.
Right. Well, I can't wait to give it a spin. It sounds like it's going to be a great way to create kind of reference structures to illustrate some of the pathological problems and some of the best design practices.
Oh, exactly.
I think that's really exciting. Before we finish, we're running out of time here. I also wanted to talk to you about some of the technologies that you guys at Samtech have introduced. And I think it was, again, maybe like 10 years ago, you guys introduced the flyover technology. What sort of data rate did you see the flyover? So first, I want you to tell a little bit about what is flyover, and then at what kind of data rate did you see the bottleneck of the circuit board interconnects where you needed to fly over them and use cable interconnects for that? So what is flyover technology?
Okay, so flyover technology is essentially the ability to solder TwinAx, high performance TwinAx, natively to the pins on a connector using either multiple different methods, including weight laser welding. The idea came out of a discussion where I looked at a QSFP connector, a modular front panel connector. And that connector has basically at the time was a went down to a printed circuit board through a right angle bend and solder tails on the printed circuit board. And I was actually sitting at Victory Brew Pub in Downingtown, Pennsylvania, with one of my sales colleagues, and we'd been talking to a customer, and I had an insight. I looked at that QSFP connector and I said, well, on one side, we plug in a DAC cable, a direct attach cable, and or we plug in an optical module. And on the other side, we go down to the printed circuit board and we deal with the printed circuit board trace losses. And we were at 28 gigabits per second then, going to 56 and then to 112. We knew that was coming. And I was looking at the problem of PCB loss and going, I don't think we can get there reliably. And I just said, what if I just took the pins and bent them up and attached TwinAx directly to them? So I basically got TwinAx attached going to a module that has TwinAx attached with a little board in it. And the signal integrity problems start going away. We're now dealing with, can we make the cable
And
that can do this, and can we do the attach process?
you're coming out the signal integrity problems go away. That's because the losses in the TwinAx are much less than on the board.
The losses in the TwinAx are almost 10 times lower than the printed circuit board, depending upon the geometry that the TwinAx, because the copper surface area around a circle is much larger than around a rectangle. If you just calculate the surface area, the copper losses are lower. We can use fluoropolymers inside of our cable. So our losses are 0.0, loss tangent is about 0.0001. It's exceedingly low. And our metals are rolled annealed. So they are 100% copper with zero roughness. Near zero roughness. So that all gives us gives us incredible signal integrity performance. And so we developed a and we already had a cable plant in Wilsonville, Oregon, building TwinAx. So we went back and did a Six Sigma characterization of the performance of the cable. We found all sorts of issues, and we went through a development process where we drove out every problem in the cable manufacturing, and we came up with cable that the biggest problem, the second problem that we were going to, I knew we were going to encounter was skew. Eventually, our skew is going to kill us. Printed circuit board skew is off the charts, even with the best practices. So we basically, in order to characterize skew, we built a test system that has 25 femtosecond Six Sigma accuracy and repeatability. Even in inserting the cable into the fixture, our entire repeatability is 175 femtoseconds. And for our next generation cable, we've got a guarantee. Our UI is about 9 picoseconds at 224 gigabits per second. So our specification internally for our cable is to keep our Six Sigma SKU below 1.75 picoseconds to limit the effect on, because we know that there will be other SKU in the system, and the system needs to have less than about 30 or 40% SKU to continue to work reliably. Mm-hmm. So that was the concept.
And using your Flyover technology, I've seen some demonstrations you've had at DesignCon of 224 gig systems that are working away.
Yeah, that's correct. So we can meet 224 gig signal integrity requirements, and we can do this both in the box and outside the box. We're in development of some next generation out of box connector systems.
Wow, very exciting, and a great vision of where the future is going for enabling a practical solution for the 224 gig systems.
Absolutely.
Well, Scott, that's all the time we have today. Thank you so much for joining me today, and look forward to staying abreast of Geek Speak, and can't wait to try out Cyborg that's coming out end of March.
Absolutely. Well, we look forward to getting it to you, and eventually maybe getting it to some of your students to play with.
Yeah, absolutely. As you're talking about it, I'm thinking, boy, you know, that would be a great vehicle for some homework problems.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yep.
Because it takes the hard part out of it, and then it just deals with the physical engineering.
Yeah.
Yep.
Can't wait.
Exactly. Well, it's always good to talk to you, Eric. It's always a pleasure.
Okay. Hey, we will be in touch. Thanks so much for joining us today.
And that concludes my interview. My thanks to Scott for joining us, and thank you, our listeners, for tuning in. I hope you check out all of our other podcasts at the Signal Integrity Journal. And that's 30 for this edition.